Liz Truelock plays with a known delaminated paddle. She didn't have any more paddles. She put down one, and she's like, yeah, I know this is bad. I don't have any others. She wins the match, and then gets the thing pet tested, and a week later, turns out that it's bad.
Is it the player's fault? Is it the manufacturer's fault? I mean, some manufacturers are choosing to make paddles to break down and degrade to benefit, and they're still putting them out because consumers buy them. Players also, especially the higher level, know when their equipment has problems, and they should be willing to put that down.
I think it's ridiculous that we have challenges. Just test the paddle beforehand, and then we don't have this problem anymore.
What's to stop me from taking a paddle that's broken in, gets it tested at 9 a.m., I don't play until noon, and I go out in the parking lot and I hit a lacrosse ball for 2 hours. How do you fix that?
Welcome back to the Future of Pickleball. I'm Paul Olson. I'm your host of this show. I've got a really interesting thing we're going to do today with the media. We've never had a major conversation with media, and I've got three very important leaders in the sport of pickleball. Let's get started. I want to introduce our group today, and we're going to start with Todd Boss. And Todd has a very, very interesting background. He writes for Forbes. He's a contributing writer for the Forbes Sports Money blog. I've got Chris Olson, who is the founder and owner of Pickleball Studio. And I've got Eric Tice, who is the contributing writer to The Dink, who covers the pro game and the college scene in general. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
I'll tell you, one of the things that I want to do is, before I get started with these guys, if you're watching this show, if you like the kind of people that we're getting on here and you enjoy our content, hit the like button, subscribe, and bang that notification bell so that you'll get these things on a predictable basis. That being said, what I want to do is I want to jump in here and I want to kind of talk about, what are the roles of media? What are the responsibilities? How do we deal with integrity of information, with conflicts, with controversies in the pickleball social media? Todd, you've got an actual real background in media and connecting with a very, very prestigious organization. Why don't you give us your thoughts?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, I think that, especially in sports media, where a lot of, not just in pickleball, but we also in other major leagues, where you see basically monopoly power of a league that controls a limited structure of, you know, a limited structure of teams and controls the flow of information, there's always this tendency to have transparency issues and questions about competition and the competitiveness and decisions that a league makes. So I think, in my perspective, sports media is there. Our primary goal from that perspective is kind of auditing the leagues, keeping them honest, making sure that the fans of the sport trust them and agree and have a concept of why decisions are being made.
Very nice. Yeah, Chris, I met you several years ago. I think you were just kind of early in starting your podcast. I remember a lunch hearing you talk about we're never going to be in the podcasting game again after doing the speed cubing podcasting. But you were a guy that I really wanted to get on this show because you had a background in podcasting before pickleball. And I don't think there's anybody else that had that history. What is your perspective on how this whole thing in the media is going?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been good at the rate it's been going right now. I think, you know, everyone's done a very good job of, for the most part, being very balanced. And I think the main goal of everyone is just to make sure everyone stays honest. Like, my role in particular is more on the paddle side than it is related to the pro game. We'll talk about it, but it's more about paddles. But the whole reason things started was to basically audit the companies and be like, yeah, you're giving us all this marketing speak and claiming all these things, but there's no one keeping you accountable to see if you're actually doing what you're saying you're doing. So that's kind of been my goal from the start. And plenty of other people have joined in on that and helped as well, which has been great.
Terrific. Eric, where you focus heavily in the pro game and the college game, how do you deal with the challenges of differing forms of information?
Yeah, there's a lot of information coming my way all the time. There's different tours in, you know, pro pickleball. There's the APP, PPA, MLP. There's international tours. And so it becomes a kind of a hierarchy for me in particular. Okay, what information is most important to my fans? And what information has the biggest movement in pro pickleball? And then I kind of go from there. And also a little caveat to that is, what information helps grow the game? And so I think all of us here would agree, like my main objective as a media member is to help grow the game. I really want to I particularly focus on the pro pickleball game, obviously. And so anything that comes through my desk, I look at with a lens of, okay, will this help my fans understand the game, and will it help the game grow? And if the answer is no to either of those, then it's probably going to be maybe a lesser article, or maybe even not even touched, because there's so many people looking for media to cover things right now.
Yeah, you know, it is really sort of interesting as we do this, and I consciously kind of chose to pick you guys out because I know you all come from a very different specific background in the sport of pickleball. You know, one of the things that I do see is there's a need in media always to be who can be first, who can get the first release, who can get the first piece of information out there. How do you deal with that and manage vetting the information that you're broadcasting? Todd, you come from the, you know, sort of the classic media world. How do you handle that?
So from my perspective, I differentiate between blogging and like breaking news and being a Twitter whore, sorry, and more conventional journalism where I'm actually writing a story or a recap or whatever. I have a really difficult time writing something in 500 or 800 words, and it's not my goal, and it's not really what I have interest. Like for example, I'll get hit up by somebody's press agent, and they're like, "Hey, under embargo till 9 a.m. tomorrow." You, Chris and Eric, I'm sure you get these like all day, every day as well. Hey, under embargo, we're going to announce something, you know, some MLTP team is going to announce a partnership, or they're going to announce something or another. Don't care about that, frankly. You know, for me, that's not a story. If it's something that's like meaningful to the industry at large, I would be interested in covering it and then adding some thoughtful, you know, narrative about it. Like that's my writing style. That's what I like to, it's not an editorial, and I certainly don't aim to be critical. But it is more talking about, hey, well, this is what's happening, and this is what I think it means for the industry as a whole.
Yeah, and, you know, on that note, one of the things that I remember, I don't remember when you did it. It's quite a while ago, but you did an article that really, it was when we were in the middle of the tour wars, and everybody hated everybody, and I really was, I've lived in this space for a pretty long time, and I've sort of seen it all develop, even from before COVID. You know, I think of BC is before COVID and AC is after COVID. And So I saw it all happen. And your article was the most accurate from my understanding of the way the industry went. And that's been, because that's really what kind of led to this show, was really kind of how do we talk about how does the media take responsibility, just like they ask other entities to take responsibility for the information that they put out. Chris, your comment about advertising speak, I spent a little bit of time in the advertising speak world making up things just because they really sounded good. You know, when you're vetting your information and your show gets more and more coverage now, you're a pretty trusted resource in the market space. What do you have to do to maintain that level of trust?
Yeah, for sure. This is actually an interesting question because I think it's something that probably a lot of the people who watch my channel don't understand. Like, I'm sure just like everyone else in this call, we get information all day, every day. Like, some things are potentially bigger news, but you may not have a good source on it. So you need to wait for more confirmation. So I feel like there's a lot of things that I'm usually sitting on until I have more information. And particularly with paddles, since that's usually what I'm covering, a lot of it is just very thoroughly playing the paddle. We're cutting open the paddles now to make sure that what they claim is in the thing is in it. And then a lot of it just comes down to play testing it, putting it in other people's hands and seeing how other people feel about it. But in terms of like news coverage for delistings, that's a whole, like, there's a lot of research and talking to different people to make sure that information is accurate. Because the way that I look at it is, yes, being first is important, but being correct or right is even more important. And becoming more and more prominent, I don't want to put out things that either add confusion or I don't know are actually correct, because that just adds to the problem that no one wants.
Yeah, you know, Eric, when we think about these things, and particularly with your involvement in the pro game, I think of a couple of things that have been coming up recently that aren't our proudest moments in pickleball. There's reports of pretty serious cheating going on because of the line call challenges, the headhunting rules and penalties. You've got to be in and around that thing. What's your take on how that's factoring into the game right now?
Yeah, I mean, I see the pro game decisions are being made, especially on the MLP side. I think we're going to see gambling in the near future again. And if we are introducing gambling, especially on the PPA tour, you know, in Major League Pickleball, you only have two courts and they have all the cameras that you want. So, you know, I don't know if there's much cheating happening there because you can just challenge and whatever on a line call. But on the PPA tour, I attended in person, PPA Tucson and PPA Mesa. And, you know, there's plenty of pro matches in the early rounds that are on court 32 that has either no cameras or maybe it does have one not so great resolution camera. And I can tell you there were some pretty contentious plays fairly regularly throughout that entire event on those kind of smaller courts because, you know, those matches are very important for those players. And there's no real way to govern those line calls. I'm specifically talking about line calls. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we have to shore that up in order to get the cheating out of the pro game altogether. How we do that is going to be a big step financially because they're going to need more cameras to do that.
You know, it's interesting. We're going to start to get into some subjects that I want to touch on that really aren't our proudest moments in the pickleball space. And it really is a little bit of a shame in the standpoint that the nature of what pickleball was in its early stages, and even really up until, in my mind, a year and a half to 2 years ago, was ethics, honesty, integrity were sort of the cores that made our sport cool and unique and engaging. And I thought that it'd be interesting for us in the media to talk about that and how we all can contribute. And or can we contribute? What can be done on that order? You know, Chris, you've been so involved here in the last 6 months of the paddle wars and, you know, and all of this stuff. As you look at it, how do you see your overall role in the pickleball space?
Yeah, I mean, basically the same way that I viewed it from the start is what I want to be is a reliable source of information that talks about like the more important subjects, like particularly recently with all the delistings. Like, I think that's very important for people to understand so that when they show up at a court or they show up at a tournament, you don't get in a fight with someone over using a illegal paddle. So to me, it's just about providing timely information that is correct, that helps people understand the paddle market better, because paddles in particular are a very confusing mess as of lately. And the target just keeps moving. And I think it's very hard for people who don't do it as a living to keep up with every paddle that's legal or might be controversial. So my goal is just to help people better understand that.
Good. You know, on that order, Todd, I know you had a very extensive background and you may still be involved with racquetball, but it is, you've got a long history with another sport that had some of its own struggles. What is your position on the ethics and the integrity of the sport of pickleball?
When it comes to equipment, and paddles?
Well, no, with just sort of the nature of the sport and the wholesomeness of the sport that we used to have.
All right, if I'm comparing it to racquetball, which has a pro tour that dates back into the 70s and has racquetball has an incredible history of, I mean, people like literally getting into fights on the court from a competition perspective, because you're two people inside of a 20 by 40 box and there's elbows being thrown and people are being tripped. Okay, we don't see that in pickleball, right? However, what we do see is just a direct result of human nature. These people are competing. You know, there's a line call. It's close. These guys are hitting this ball 60, 70 miles an hour. It's zooming by you. Is it on the line? Is it an inch over? I don't know. I play just like you guys do. And I frequently say, if I call a ball in, I'm like, yeah, that was in, but that was tournament out. And I'm not, and that sounds maybe like I'm a cynic. However, this is exactly what we see these players do. Tournament, that ball was close. It's out because the incentives for them are many. You know, you guys talked about a lot of these bad calls on court 32 are in the early rounds. These are players that are not under salary. These are players that often paid $1,000 to get into this tournament because they're trying to move their way up. And if that shot, if that call means the difference between moving on and getting onto a show court and being able to, you know, show their sponsor that they're getting some view, which might lead them to getting a better equipment and a better deal, I totally get it. And I have no problem explaining that away. It's also worth saying that these people see each other too often. These guys are playing each other 35 times a year, right? You want to know why Ben Johns put a missile at Huang Duong's head? It's because they play too much. These guys are playing like every other week. You've got hundreds of guys. Not every one of them is going to get along. And then, Paul, this goes back to your concept about, you know, the good old days where everybody was nice and cordial and no one purposely hit each other in the head or in the body. That's not the way that the sport's played anymore. These guys are purposely hitting missiles at your body, at your chest, because if you're either going to get a pop-up for an easy hit or they're going to hit you and then it's their point. You know, 10 years ago, that would have been anathema. No one ever would have thought to do that in competition. Now it happens about every other round. So these are consequences of just kind of the way the pro game is evolving from a personality and from a risk-reward perspective.
You know, Eric, we just recently had a situation in the pro game that was the first one, and it kind of overlaps with Chris's world. And that was when Travis Rettenmeier provided the first paddle challenge in the history of the pro game, and he won. And I actually I wasn't aware of what the consequences were for the player that was challenged if they turned out to be using a cheating paddle, or that the player that called them on it could be financially punished if they weren't using an illegal paddle. And it is how do you see the paddle relationship between the player and the player's sponsor? How do you see that evolving in the pro game?
Yeah, that's a good question. A couple things on that to give the audience a background. First of all, Travis was playing with Elise Jones against Eric Roddy and Liz Truluck in PPA Mesa. It is of note that Liz Truluck was the one who had her paddle challenged, and it was a Yola paddle. Liz is a free agent in terms of paddles. She is not sponsored by Yola, and she did not receive that paddle from Yola. She received it second party through another, I believe, another signed Yola player. I don't know that to be 100% true. But so that gives you a little bit of background there. Now, with that being said, I do think if a player is sponsored by a paddle company and they lose a challenge like that, I do think that probably the paddle company should be taking some onus in that and helping with the fees for the audience. Liz Truluck, because the paddle was challenged and the paddle was deemed illegal, she is now fined $2,500 by the UPAA if the paddle was found to be legal, Travis would have been fined $1,000. Now, when it comes to that, all of that being said, I think, me personally, I think it's ridiculous that we have challenges. Just test the paddle beforehand. It's a round of 64 match. It's a main draw match. I think every main draw match should be having paddles tested before with the little sticker. And then we don't have this problem anymore. So I think we just need to move that. I think the PPA Tour starts testing at round of 32. We just, anything in the main draw, let's just test it beforehand. Because if it was tested beforehand, I know that the paddle would have failed and Liz would not have played with that paddle. So that's my take on that.
Well, Eric, so, sort of interesting. Chris and I were at an event, two months ago, that was USA Pickleball's media event, where they were talking about how they were testing and what their new protocols were going to be. And a real topic of conversation at that event was really evolved into who should be responsible. Should the governing body be responsible for this? Should the manufacturer be responsible for following the rules? Do the players have anything to do with it? And one of the things that I think in this group of us is, what can we in the media do to help solve these problems? Because we're all looking for positive things to talk about, but unfortunately, we also get some negative things that go on in the sport. Chris, how do you see that factoring into the way you approach reviewing paddles?
In terms of like equipment breaking or issues with equipment?
Well, in terms of who might be responsible. So you're not involved in the pro game. You're not involved with any of the manufacturers directly. But when a situation like this comes up where there was obviously, when one player can feel the response of another player's ball, and you know what that, you deal with that all the time. How do you think that should be dealt with in the sport from the media perspective?
Yeah, I think it's a very tricky situation. And I think this is part of why everyone's so frustrated with paddles right now is there's like, is it the player's fault? Is it the manufacturer's fault? I mean, some manufacturers are choosing to make paddles that are very well known at this point to break down and degrade to benefit. And they're still putting them out because consumers buy them. Even if people know there's a problem, people like how they play. And there's a lot of people who still just don't even understand what the problem is. And even more confusing is there are paddles that are very, very hard for an average consumer to know is actually broken, that do have issues. And the only way you're going to catch it is with like x-rays or cutting the paddle open, which are not feasible for amateurs to do or most tournaments to do. So it's a very tricky situation right now, and it's hard to figure out who to pin it on, but it's something that needs to be figured out. Personally, my opinion is that it should be more on the manufacturers to be putting out more durable products because they know there's an issue and they know what consumers want, and they're still producing some of these paddles. But players also, especially the higher level, know when their equipment has problems and they should be willing to put that down. But I think there are some situations that are more cut and dry and others that are less so.
You know, Eric, on that note, one of the things that occurred to me, I've seen an awful lot of payment and punishment as a means of managing behavior in different sports through my lifetime. And one of the things that struck me is $2,500 seemed like baby change to me. Because in the standpoint, the manufacturer's always, the player's not going to pay the $2,500. The manufacturer's going to pick that up. And for them, $2,500 to get caught is a very, very modest thing. Do you know if there's any other, well, like you say, so she wasn't a sponsored player of that manufacturer. I think we, the collective of people who aren't directly involved with either the players or the manufacturers, need to be in a position to start calling these things out because they're not in the best interest of our sport. Does that make any sense? Anybody that
wants for sure. I think 100%. Todd had something to say.
Well, okay. Well, Eric, I was going to give you a follow-up question. Okay. I'm going to compare and contrast two situations to you. Liz Truelock plays with a known delaminated paddle. If you listen to Travis Rettenmeyer's description of the situation, she didn't have any more paddles. She put down one and she's like, yeah, I know this is bad. I don't have any others. She wins the match. So she sends a guy out of the tournament, right? and then gets the thing pet tested, and a week later turns out that it's bad. $2,500 fine. Okay. Meanwhile, Andre Daescu has a paddle that never shows up on a court. It's somebody accidentally pulled the wrong paddle. It was clearly a training paddle because all these guys train with paddles with sticky stuff on it to implement more spin. We know this. Gets it tested. He gets fined $50,000 and he's suspended for months. What the hell? Those two situations make zero sense to each other. It's almost as if when George Brett got called out for using a bat to hit a home run in the game, and if the Yankees had gone right there and said that bat's bad, then they would have been like, we'll test it later and we'll give you an answer in a week. Well, they can't go backwards, you know. They can't go back and replay the tournament. So that's the big problem that I have with the lack of testing, with the lack of action right there when the paddle challenge occurs.
Right. And what I was trying to say was that paddle should have been tested before they even started the match. And I believe UPAA just starts testing at round of 32. And with this year there's the PPA gold card, right? And so if you're a gold card member, you are required to play every single cup and every single slam. And what that means is, obviously, there's like extenuating circumstances. Players can have situations where they can't play. They have to get an excused absence. But there are over 140 UPA signed players, right? So you're guaranteed every round of 64. And we saw in the Mesa tournament, there's round of 128. Starting in these tournaments. And so if we're forcing all these players to play in these tournaments, in these high level tournaments, which I understand, then we should be testing the paddles beforehand and they should be approved before they start the main draw is my point.
Well, what's to stop me from taking a paddle that's broken in, gets it tested at 9 a.m. I don't play until noon. And I go out in the parking lot and I hit a lacrosse ball for 2 hours and I delam the crap out of it. Then I go to my match, it sounds hollow. It sounds like, and the thing, the ball's shooting off of it like a rubber ball. And Travis Rettenmeyer says, that's ridiculous. It is what it is. It tested. How do you fix that?
You know, one of the things that came up when we were in Maryland with the USA Pickleball's Media Day was exactly this conversation. And I kind of took a little bit of a different position than I think a lot of the other people did. And that is, my mindset is that this needs to be the manufacturer's 100% sole responsibility because of the fact that so the testing protocols, whether it's UPAA or whether it's USA Pickleball, as they create their test requirements, exactly what you're saying, Todd, is it's the manufacturer's responsibility that if they've got a sponsored player or they've got a player who's damaging the paddle for benefit, it has to fall back on the manufacturer's responsibility. They're really the only ones that can police it. You know, we have another issue, and I really want to get some feedback from you on this, Chris, because I know you're deeply involved in it, where we hear the term, well, this batch of paddles. Well, all these manufacturers, so many manufacturers that are dealing with offshore manufacturing, third-party manufacturers, that was a world I lived in for 30 years. If you think that you're going to get consistent production out of factories out of Asia, I think you might be a little naive. So subsequently, whose responsibility is that? In my mind, it seems that that's the manufacturer's responsibility. It's their brand that's on the paddle. Any thoughts, Chris?
Yeah, for sure. I actually do think it's up to the manufacturer in order to better produce paddles. And I think an interesting thing that the industry has seen is like clearly there's a huge benefit to selling the types of paddles right now that break because again people are buying them and they're liking them, so the company is incentivized to go, let's produce as many of these as possible because we're just making money left and right and we're not being punished for it. And I think at the media day, you know, my stance was like USAP needs to do a better job of this because right now the manufacturers don't seem to particularly care about fixing the issue because it's benefiting them. So the only other next step is to have someone like USAP come in and say, we see what you guys are doing. We see what's happening to the game. We see how many of these paddles are out in the wild. This is unacceptable. And now we're going to start either putting a fine in place or handing out some type of suspension to prevent companies from abusing the system where they know consumers will just buy this paddle? Because right now, nothing is really stopping them. I mean, paddles are still breaking to benefit all the time, whereas historically, 2 or 3 years ago, when a paddle broke, it was done. Like, you didn't want to play with it anymore because it hurt you. Now, when it breaks, it makes you better or helps you in some cases.
You know, you could do our audience a favor by just expanding on that. What do you mean by when a paddle breaks, that it can be better for you?
Yeah, so in most cases right now, really just what that means is, like, most cores are made of plastic polymer honeycomb. So a lot of times when they're building these paddles at the factory, there's too much pressure or heat in the mold, which squishes it down and essentially just turns it into a trampoline. The easiest way to see if your paddle's broken, it doesn't apply universally, but most times it's a good sign to check, is if you just take your thumbs and press in the center of your paddle, if you hear clicking, crunching, or it sounds like things are just breaking when you do that, there's a good chance your paddle's breaking. And no, just pressing your thumbs is not going to break it. Like, I mean, I could beat a paddle with a ball and some of them won't break. Like, your thumbs, you're not going to press hard enough to break it with your thumb. If it cracks when your thumb pressed, it was already broken.
Now, when you say it's broken, does that affect the overall lifetime then of the paddle?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at some point, that paddle is just going to become likely very dead. There seems to be a period where it gets very hot, and then after enough use, it just becomes very inconsistent or unpredictable. Like, certain patches are really hot, other patches are really dead, and it can make the paddle a little more inconsistent. But there's definitely a sweet spot where it hits harder than it should, and people really love when it's in that sweet spot.
You know, I think we've kind of covered the paddle effect pretty well here. You know, something that I wanted to kind of ask you guys as a collective, and I'll ask each of you to respond independently, is as you're looking at yourself and your own brand in the market ball or in the pickleball space, where do you see your brand going, and what are your hopes for where media in your brand will go? Todd, let's start with you.
That's an interesting question. I'm like Eric. I find myself, most of what I write ends up being like pro tournament recaps. If I had more time, I would do previews and recaps like what Eric does. But at the end, it's all recaps. But interestingly, if you look at all of my stories from the day I started writing and you order them by the number of clicks or page views, not one pro recap is in the top 20 of any of my stories ever. Sure. And so I face this conundrum. Like, I love the pro game. I really, really like the behind the scenes stuff with MLP, you know, the drafts and the trades and the analysis and the grades and, you know, and this kind of this behind, because that's like the essence of like team building. It's the same stuff that we used to cover in like baseball and football, right? You know, I'm GM for a day. I get to talk about it. But what I keep forgetting is that 90 some odd percent of the pickleball playing world does not care about the pro game. They couldn't pick Ben Johns or Anna Lee Waters out of a lineup. However, when I write something that's more general interest, or I talk about eye guards or building indoor facilities, or one of my biggest click ever was this kind of tongue-in-cheek article I wrote about characters you see in open play. And it was just jokes about the jokers that you run into in open play. You know, the guy who cheats, the guy who has the illegal serve and won't listen to you, the guy who knows everything, the guy who screams at his whites, you know, and it was just fun. And so I wish that I had more time to write those articles. But at the same time, covering the pro game is super important because the pro game drives all the money. It drives the sponsors. It drives the manufacturing. And so we need a balance there of some sort.
Eric, you know, where you cover the pro game as well, well, how much do you think the development of the player personalities are a factor in the sport at the pro game going forward?
Yeah, I think that is the number one thing in growing the sport. I think fans need to be able to understand who these players are as people, where they came from, their backgrounds. I try to do that. Todd and I do this very similarly. I write for the Dink exclusively, and that is obviously a pickleball specific media outlet. And, you know, my articles, if you were to talk to Thomas Shields, my articles do not do nearly as well as those general pickleball pieces. It's just a known thing, but we want to be able to cover the pro game for all the reasons that Todd just said, right? So, you know, I may write a, just to Todd's point, my recaps are probably just the same as him in terms of like views, in terms of compared to other things. So, you know, my number one article that was read by the general public last year was a player profile on Kate Fahey. When she came out of nowhere, I got to interview her and I do a player profile. I've done probably 20 or 30 of them, but I could probably do one a week for the rest of my life, and we probably still wouldn't have the stories that we need. So yeah. I think as we continue to develop the pro game, I think it's telling the stories of the players and not just saying, you know, everybody who watches pro pickleball knows who Annalie and Ben are and knows that, you know, Annalie was good at soccer and all of those things. But there's a whole bunch of players out there that I think people could relate to. And so telling those stories is super important. So.
So that, you know, Chris, this leads to a kind of an interesting perspective that I've got, having been a sporting goods industry professional my whole life, is we, as an industry, we want to grow and develop these personalities. The manufacturers want to align themselves through sponsorship with key players. And then the equipment side of it sometimes actually gets a little muddied. I've even heard people suggesting that there may become paddles that are designed only for pro players, which to me, that seems like the dumbest endorsement arrangement you could possibly do. You want the consumer, you want the consumer to buy the paddle because they like Tyson McGuffin or Ben John. How do you see that playing out on the equipment side?
Yeah, I see why people may potentially want that. Just with where the pro game's going, they probably should be using more toned down paddles, and it may be less problematic for amateurs to use paddles that are a little bit more powerful. But I do think it would cause interesting issues by only having paddles that pros use. And then, you know, consumer nature, I think, is just going to go, well, I want what they're using. Like, how can I, exactly, how can I get my hands on one of those? Same thing with, you know, it happens with tennis rackets. There are tennis rackets or pros that are using tennis rackets that are not actually what is being sold. It's paint job to something older that they liked, or maybe another model. It's like, there's clearly examples of that out there, but in pickleball, I feel like that would not be a great thing. And there'd be a lot of people upset that they can't go buy the same paddle that Tyson uses and, you know, whoever else.
You know, something that I wanted to, and I know Chris will know about this. I'm not exactly sure how Eric and Todd, if you're following what's being projected in terms of the PEMA or the Pickleball Equipment Manufacturers Association, but I'm a very strong believer because of having been in industries that the trade association was a very, very strong control agent in terms of what the manufacturers put out. And largely because there's generally a commitment to honesty and integrity. By being a member of an association, they're agreeing that they know what the rules are, that they have to comply with them. And within their own organization, they would be excoriated, you know, without doing it. Do you think, and I'll go back to Todd on this one, do you think that the idea of a governing, or not, excuse me, I don't want to use the word governing, it's not a governing body, but a trade association designed to help add consistency and predictability to paddle manufacturing, that would be something that would be advantageous?
I mean, I think it would. Do I think that that's where the industry is now? No. I think what you have right now is a slew of manufacturers, right? Yeah. What does USAP have? Like 300 manufacturers on their approved list right now. That's just, you know, you're going to see over the years, you're going to see that whittle down. And you're going to see people start to focus and paddles are going to start to get differentiated on their engineering, right? You're not going to be able to just call up random factory in China and spit out the exact same looking thing that 20 other manufacturers have with just a little bit of different ink on it. You think about the paddles that are different from an engineering perspective now, you know, Selkirk or Gearbox and EULA, like these guys are going to start to overtake and be in the market. To answer your specific question, for me, it comes down to incentives. Right, you have USAP and now USAA that are UPAA that are kind of putting in very similar exit velocity tests. Right, you know, 1.44, 1.43 from a ratio perspective. That's what they're going to manufacture to. And the only thing that an equipment council might do is maybe they go to the two and be like, you guys are squeezing us. We need to move it to 0.44 or 0.45, or, you know, try to speak as a group. But they're going to act in their own best interest because that's just human nature.
You know, it's sort of interesting because I see things a little bit different in the standpoint that one of the hurdles that has happened in the manufacturing and the confusion of manufacturing that we've had is I think it actually is detrimental to pickleball paddle sales. So the idea of, in my mind, the market space is how fast can we as an industry grow the pie? Everybody gets fed as we're getting more and more paddles. The concept or this idea now of having, and it's literally just a couple of manufacturers that are the ones that are sort of always in the center of this challenge, it raises questions with the consumer. I hear it from retailers all the time. They're talking about how do they answer these questions that the consumer's asking them about, will my paddle be good 3 months from now or 6 months from now? And I wonder if the idea of a governing organization. So one of the things, as an example, is that the rules, the current rules of governing the standards in pickleball, is that the paddle has to stay within compliance through the lifetime of the paddle. Well, everything that we talked about with Chris was that some of them are doing things after the paddle has been applied, then it's changing. But that if it becomes the manufacturer's responsibility, that they know if they can create a paddle that they know will change, they can make a paddle that they know won't change. And so I wonder about that. And Chris, you're the guy that lives in this paddle space all the time. What are your thoughts that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just goes back to why I feel like USAP policing it is so important, is because with the incentives that people have to make the types of paddles, no one wants to be the first one to be like, hey, we made a really durable paddle, but it doesn't hit that hard and maybe the grit's not as good. Like what the consumer wants is they want a cannon and they want as much spin as they can. So manufacturers will just keep pushing the limit in terms of grit. And if you don't have the governing body to come in and be like, hey, cut that out, like you're not allowed to do that, they will always, just like Todd said, put their self-interest above everything else. And then there are going to be companies who abide by the rules, but I see this all the time. Companies that play by the rules and even produce paddles that don't break, they just don't get talked about because they don't care because they don't get the same performance that they can get from paddles that are breaking. So it's this really weird thing where I just feel like if USAP had a much harder stance on like, okay, we're seeing enough of these break, that's just got to go. Then companies, if they're getting a penalty for it, go, okay, consumers, this is what you get. This is the best that's going to exist because we don't want to deal with the punishment anymore. But if they're just getting dollar bills from consumers buying these, they don't care.
But then with the influx of news, you know, we've sort of got new podcasters coming into the sport now the way paddle manufacturers did 2 years ago, where, you know, we had a handful. So now you've got sort of the old salt like yourself, but it is the cost of entry to become a podcaster in the pickleball space and test paddles is pretty low. And yeah, we're seeing this start to come in all over the place. Where there's actually, isn't there a benefit in having all this controversial stuff and these new paddles that nobody ever heard of a week ago, but now it gives you something to have content about? Isn't there some level of responsibility in the media to understand what the rules and compliance of the game are and are helping to simply maintain where the sport is going through that understanding?
Yeah, for sure. No, I completely think that's a thing. And I think that's what we try to do our best to. Like, I mean, if you watch a lot of my reviews, I'm extremely, extremely vocal to the point that it's probably annoying more of my audience than it is anything else. But I talk all the time about this paddle breaks or we experience this. You may want to be cautious about purchasing this. And like, this is going to cause problems. And I think people are almost sick of me saying that. So personally, I wish everyone would abide by the rules as much as humanly possible, because I just think it's better for everyone else. And yes, controversy, it gives us stuff to talk about, but at least from my perspective, it's not stuff that I want to talk about. Sure, I don't want to talk about governance of paddles. When I get a paddle in my hand, I just want to tell you how it plays and be done with it. I don't want to give you warnings about breaking, or maybe it gets delisted, maybe it doesn't. Like, those things do get clicks and people like to hear about it. But I personally do not like talking about it. But I cover it because I think it's important for people to be in the loop.
So I'm going to take a quick commercial break here, guys. And I want to say thank you to Selkirk TV for allowing me to put on these kind of interviews and shows. If you're not using the Selkirk TV app on your phone, you're missing the greatest resource there is in the sport for information, for podcasters, even live coverage of PPA events from time to time. Go to the Selkirk TV on your app platform and download it. Gentlemen, I want to get narrowed down to sort of aiming this sort towards a completion. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to have each of you give me a little bit of an idea of what your thoughts and ideas are on something that the audience will like to know about that you see coming in the not too distant future. And Eric, let's start with you.
Okay. I do think that gambling will be back in pro pickleball very shortly, within the next 6 months or so. It seemed like a test type of situation in 2024, with like one or two gambling sites and maybe up to 10 states. If anybody has any better information than that, correct me by all means. But it seemed like it was like a tester, and now decisions seem to be being made, especially on the MLP level, that seem to hint that gambling could be coming to the sport sooner rather than later.
Very nice. Very nice. Todd, your turn.
I believe that the rise of prize purses in international competitions is going to soon start rivaling what these players are earning in their exclusive UPA contracts. And it's going to have some players asking some very serious questions of the PPA, as in, like, let me out of my contract. I'm making nothing, and all of these non-signed players are making a ton of money. And that's going to come to a head because the UPA, as of late, has been acting in a way that is literally repelling a certain type of player. Like, they are banning people. They've created this band where if you're ranked too highly but you're not a signed player, you literally can't play their events. And so they are actually increasing the talent levels on their competitors. And I think that as international money purses start to rise, that's going to lead very quickly to this kind of duality that they're not going to be able to manage.
That's interesting. Before I jump into Chris, I want to mention I did an interview with a man named Pran Kohli from India, who is one of the organizers of one of the foreign big money tours. And I asked him specifically about how would he deal with the elite level players. And he said he thought that that would take care of itself in the next couple of years when their contracts are running out and they need to renew them. They're going to be having a very different number of thoughts to make on how they want their career to be managed and controlled. So that could very well be the case. And Chris, what do you see going on?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that I have any big upcoming news. I think for me, it's just more of a hope that paddle testing gets figured out or manufacturers start policing things better, because it's just exhausting for everyone. I mean, I think with paddles, like, people just want to show up to the court and play pickleball. Like, they don't want to show up and like look at the guy and be like, hey, you, like, I heard on a podcast that's illegal, like, you shouldn't use that. And then that person's never heard that. Like, I just hope that it all gets figured out and we can go back to just playing the sport.
Very nice. Guys, I want to thank you all very much for joining me today. This is just great. I really looked forward to this. We're going to post each of your links in the on the podcast, so people will be able to find you guys. Let's all keep it going, and let's keep the media focused on being an advocate for the goodness of the sport, because I may be old and naive, but it really feels to me like that is the one thing that I see in pickleball that was never experienced in any of the other sports that I saw growing up. And I think it contributed tremendously to this enormous growth we're doing domestically. And in, I know it's contributing to what's happening internationally. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me today. Take care. See you on the court.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.